Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Once a month, Mayor Vi Lyles is on the program, and she's back today. We've got bunches of things to talk about and get updated on, including the city's new strategies to reduce violent crime and to focus on improving transit and transportation, and that just scratches the surface. So let's get to it. Welcome back. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here.
It's good to be here, and thanks to all the people that listen and send me emails and texts afterwards. I really appreciate that, so thanks, Mike.
Really? They do that?
Oh, yeah. I get a lot of feedback about this hour that we spend, and sometimes it's great, and sometimes it's just okay. But I appreciate that people listen, and that's really a testament to understanding that we have to talk about what's important in the city.
Well, this is our 20th conversation.
Wow.
Okay. I make a note of that.
I'm looking for my birthday cake or my anniversary cake.
Bring something with candles
yes.
on it. President Trump put something in his tax bill in 2017 called Opportunity Zones, and it passed through Congress, I said, in 2017. He talked about that in the State of the Union message last week. He was in town last Friday at CPCC mm-hmm. for North Carolina Opportunity Now Summit, and while he was here, he mentioned they'd set up 9,000 Opportunity Zones around the country. I think 250 in North Carolina. We have 17. Here in Charlotte, who designates these areas as opportunity zones? Who makes that decision?
Well, the bill and the federal agency designated the criteria for the zones, and that was a combination of first census tracts. All of our cities divided up on a map and at the federal level that creates census tracts, and then those census tracts had to have certain characteristics. So basically it was around areas of high unemployment, low investment, and those zones generally are what we would in our city call the crescent. We used to call it city within a city, but those areas where we seeing not as much investment as we would like, and those are the areas that were designated as zones. Freedom Drive Corridor, Bates Ford Road Corridor, Eastland, Albemarle Central Corridors, those corridors. We're all familiar with them.
I think it's an apt name because it has so many different meanings. Opportunity zone. It's opportunity for the people in those areas who have been left behind. It's opportunity for land to be developed that has languished. But it's also opportunity for people who invest money in these zones. They're permitted to defer taxes on the sale of stock, delay taxes on the projects they're building. And in fact, long-term investments in these areas are now taxed at zero. So Trump says these zones lift up underserved communities. Others say that developers are getting tax breaks for projects they would have built anyway. What's your take?
My take is a combination of all of that. When this opportunity zone concept was introduced, I actually had an opportunity to sit with Tim Scott, who is the senator South Carolina. And this was kind of his brainchild because he grew up in an area that would be considered an opportunity zone. And he was saying, how do I get people to come in and see the value of the people that live there, making sure that they have the opportunity to start small businesses, to launch their own ideas, but they need investment. And so it took a while, even though this was 2017, the rules didn't come out until 2019 in December because there was lots of negotiation. You had the ideal that Senator Scott was talking about, but it went to Treasury to figure out the tax opportunities for people to invest. So what I think is that we're going to have to wait and see. Local governments, cities, I've talked very much with the mayors around the country, particularly in the South, Birmingham, Jackson, Mississippi. They have been able to do more because they're in places where the investments are really, really necessary to even jumpstart. For us, it's a little bit more complicated. We've got a lot of successes, so how do we make sure that the success that we're having in other corridors moves over without the unintended consequences that we might have because it is a tax deal?
That's more benign than I thought what you were going to say, because you told the Observer's Daniel Shemtob that opportunity zones are a tax shelter for high wealth individuals and trust funds.
And that's true. That's exactly what we're talking about. So how do we influence what those folks that come in for trust funds and high wealth individuals, how do we use our civic engagement that we have in this community with high wealth individuals and trust funds to say, we're still building a great city. So will you help us by doing it in a way that incorporates our value system around reinvestment in these corridors?
So these could be good or bad, depending upon how you keep tabs on them? Is that essentially
what
you're saying?
Well, it's not keeping tabs. What the city has been thinking about is how do we communicate first what we want to see in those zones. So think about Eastland and what we've communicated around how we want to invest in a development on that existing 60-plus acres at the former Eastland site, and to say we're going to be building housing, retail, and we're going to have an MLS team. So now let's take that down Albemarle. The Albemarle Road does need revitalization. It doesn't look like our boulevard should look. So how do we tell people this is what we want to see in your rezonings? This is what we would like to see you invest in. So as a city, what we're trying to do is target specific strategies to say, if you will do housing, we will help you with the housing trust fund. If you will build the right kind of infrastructure, we'll help you with some of our tax opportunities that we would match. So let's look at this as a collaboration and a partnership and not leave it to one person to say, well, I'm going to plop this down in the middle of something. We're trying to do it in a way that's comprehensive.
When he was here last week, the president praised you and city council when he said that Democratic leaders here understand that the administration intends opportunity zones to be a method of dealing with gentrification, but some folks on the ground in these opportunity zones see these as opportunities for gentrification, not the opposite. So do you and council stand with the president on this in terms of your understanding of the purpose of these zones and how you hope they will be used, and do you really have any control over how they will be used?
We have local control. But you're right, those investors could come in, they can get control of the land, but what I count on is our regulatory processes, if they have to have for rezoning, if they have to have investments to help them be successful. I don't think anybody's going to come in and be an investor for a complete geography. So that means there's partnerships that have to be related. So do I agree with the president in that we need to have participation locally influence the development? Absolutely, yes. And that's what I believe our council is doing, particularly around where we are looking at investments around our rail system. All of those things fit. So you asked if how we work, and I want to say this. I got a few letters after our emails about the president being here, and you know what this city wants is to work to get our federal dollars that we send to Washington back here to be used in a way that furthers the kind of city we want to grow and develop. And so I see this as an opportunity to work with the White House administration and to say, here's where we think we can fit some of the things. There are a number of policies that are integrated that could help in opportunity zones, housing, reentry opportunities, training and workforce development for people to be able to get jobs and help create these zones. So yes, I think that if we take the rules and legislation and believe in that intent, that's what we're going to try to deliver.
You're on a White House task force, is that correct? What is what's it called?
It is the Workforce Development Task Force for the White House.
Do you meet with the president or do you meet with the subordinates?
No, we meet with, first, the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump, is the chair, along with the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross. And so we meet with them. But the group is made up of business, government, and educational institutions. So when you sit around the table, most of the people in the room are more like me than the officials of the White House.
Okay. So do you think, in your heart of hearts, that the president believes that these opportunity zones will, in fact, uplift blighted areas and communities and improve lives, or do you believe that he really sees this as a way for his rich cronies to get richer?
I don't know what's in the president's heart.
Okay. These 17 opportunity zones in Charlotte, they will be improved, in your opinion, through this program?
Will our areas be improved?
Yeah,
I believe that. I think that there will be improvement. But every time we do something like this, we have to be very conscious of unintended consequences. Gentrification may happen no matter what we do. So how do we try to set principles and guidance
around
that?
Isn't it fairly assured to happen? If you take an area that has not been touched economically or in terms of development for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, and suddenly you develop it, isn't it going to attract more investment and therefore push people out who are on the lower socioeconomic levels?
So let's just take as an example, if I've got the guy that does carpet cleaning out on Albemarle Road or Central Avenue, and he's renting a place right now to have his business, and we want him to stay there, wouldn't we try to provide local incentives to make that possible? So, you know, just like we're
what would those incentives
be?
Well,
let's just say you're going to build a retail space. I mean, even at Eastland, we're talking about building a retail space. If we're going to build a retail space, how do we make sure that that business has a chance to compete for that lease and stay where they are? So I think that this is really going to get down to the granular level of talking to people about what are you going to build, and will you allocate spaces for small businesses, the existing businesses? What will the rents be? How do we get people ready to know if rents are going to rise? How do you prepare your business for that? Can you expand your business in the time frame that we have to grow to be able to do that? So I believe that our goal is to have as much local participation in these efforts as possible.
Jayron, I hope I'm saying their name right. Jayron Smith, isn't it?
Jayron
is an advisor to Donald Trump. He believes that these zones are, is it a man or a woman, by the way?
It is a man.
Okay.
From Cleveland.
Okay. He believes the zones are being unfairly maligned, and he says gentrification is not something that wasn't happening already. It was already happening way before Opportunity Zone legislation became law, and he says the mass buildup of urban areas has been happening across the country way before this. Is he right?
I tell the story about gentrification. I love Malachi Green, former city council member, Republican, Democrat, but basically an advocate for the minority community, the African-American urban community. And Malachi said, gentrification can be both good and bad. If someone has the ability to make money with gentrification by selling their home and sending their kids to college, perhaps, or giving them the opportunity to start a business, that's creating wealth for that family longer term. But it can also be bad when it's used in a predatory sense, like sending, you know, older family members cards every day, I'll buy your house for cash, I'll buy your house for cash. So we've got a balance there. So how do we try to deal with this? We have to really call on each other to say, how do we bond together neighborhoods? I'm going to be meeting later on this week with Daryl Gaston and his community over off of North Tryon Street. And they're very, very concerned about gentrification because they've lived there, they've been there for a long time, and those homes are getting those cards every day, I'll buy your house, I'll buy your house. But if neighborhood leaders understand that they can put together a strong organization, a neighborhood response is that we're not going to sell the house, we're going to give you someone to talk to about real estate values and what your choices are. Because selling your house at $200,000 may not give you the chance to live in Charlotte, but it may give you a chance to do something that you want to do. Those are individual decisions that have created wealth in this community for a long time.
We have to take a break in a second. This is an inopportune time because we've got to fill 40 seconds, but I don't want to launch into the next question because it's a long one, and it requires you to look deeply into the mind of the President of the United States, because we're going to talk a little bit more about opportunity zones, and then we're going to move on to the 2040 plan. Yes, it's that time again to talk about a new plan for Charlotte, and we have about, 20 years to make this happen. So we'll talk about what goes into doing that, what you're looking forward in that plan, and do these plans really mean anything? Are they followed, essentially? Mayor Vial Isles is with us. She'll be here for the hour, and we will continue in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles is our guest for the hour. Donald Trump has framed these Opportunity Zone projects as part of his overall attempts to help African Americans. He made a plea to these voters in the last election campaign, telling them, essentially, that Democrats had used them with little in return. So, quote, what have you got to lose? He said that on the stump. And at CPCC last week, he said, quote, you've been with the Democrats for 100 years, 112 years, and they treat you badly, end quote. This, too, is an election year. Do you see this as a campaign ploy to garner favor with African Americans, or do you believe that he and policies like Opportunity Zones and that First Step Act, which is designed to make the criminal justice system fairer, are actually doing something to better the lives of African Americans?
As a democratically elected mayor in the city, and what I see as a city that wants to do right by people, if we really want to see some change in this country, the people that have worked every day to make this country successful so that there can be millionaires and billionaires are not suffering from the lack of programming. It's the lack of support for their individual lives around, why aren't we forgiving student debt? Why aren't we doing something about the overwhelming debt that people have invested in their careers and the ability to work? Why does child care cost $15,000 a year? Why are rents rising so quickly? Why do we have medical bills that you can't pay? So I am one of the people that I'm known for long-term thinking, and I can appreciate opportunity zones. But if you really want to change this issue in our country, in this city, it is an affordability issue, not an opportunity issue. It's like, help us invest in the areas of where everyday people need the ability to live in an urban setting. And if I had priorities as a Democratic mayor, or even just as a woman that works in the city every day, I want to see investment in infrastructure for our transit system. I'd like to see investments where our universities get stronger instead of having to increase costs for people that are trying to be trained for the jobs of the future. I'd like to see us actually work around the issues that impact people on a daily basis. To me, that is this country's that place that we have either an opportunity to change. Mm-hmm. And I love long term. I do. But when I talk to families that say, I am not having a child because I can't afford daycare, that's just not what we are.
Well, plus, you have to plan 10 years in advance for to get in. There's a waiting list. You were invited to attend the president's address at the
yes.
Opportunity Conference on Friday last week at CPCC. You didn't.
Why not?
Well,
one, I was working. And two, and the president's going to be here. We're hosting the Republican National Convention.
But you're not attending that either, I'm told.
Right, that's true. And that's what I'm saying. My job is to do the best work, to work with the White House to get Charlotte's agenda completed. It's not my job to always be present for political events. And I have to say, I know that I'm very respectful of the White House. I'm very respectful of any office. I like that same respect as mayor sometimes as well. But basically, at some point, there is a difference between a campaign and governance.
So you saw this as a campaign stop?
No, actually, I didn't. I knew I had something to do on Friday that was going to be important. So I met with the White House staff and said, okay, tell me how we're coming along with the projects that we'd like to see in Charlotte.
Okay.
That doesn't mean that I'm going to always be at a campaign or political event.
Because District 2 Councilman Malcolm Graham said he doesn't have any faith or confidence in this administration. And he said, quote, I don't want to be part of a stage production. Do you share that view?
I do share that view. This is about work, not just showing up and shaking hands.
But won't this entire city be part of a stage production in August?
I think that we will be the physical site of a stage production produced by the Republican Convention.
every official appearance that the president makes, and not just him, I think any president, when they're running for re-election, any official visit they make anywhere is could be considered a campaign stop. But in his case, he takes jabs at Democratic candidates, even on official visits, presidential visits, not campaign stops. And on Friday, at the Opportunity Summit, he spoke about the Iowa results, which were still trickling in, and he said, let's see, who won? Oh, it turned out to be Pete Buttigieg, whoever the hell he is. Mayor Pete, explain that one to me, he said. That's a quote. And I bring that up because even some Democrats are asking the question, who is this Pete Buttigieg? Why is a mayor of a small city running for president? And now we have another mayor of a big city running for president who's running, he's going to be running as a Democrat, but he's not really a Democrat. And I'm talking about Michael Bloomberg. You're a mayor.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel qualified to run for president?
Mike, I guess I'd have to leave that up to the electorate. I think that's what these other folks are doing. They're basically saying, I feel that I'm capable of doing
inside,
this.
Get inside Pete Buttigieg.
My name's
get
not
inside,
on that list.
Get inside Pete Buttigieg's head.
I can't.
That's
do
hard
that.
To say, Pete Buttigieg.
Buttigieg in the head, that's right.
Get inside his head. I mean, he was a small town mayor, although I think they have a strong mayor system in South Bend. Do you see where he could feel that he could be ready for this? Certainly Michael Bloomberg, because he's rich and he ran New York City.
I would hope that both of them are doing this based upon their understanding of both what it takes to operate and govern in this country, not just where they live and where they've been successful. I would hope that both of them as mayors have had to deal with issues that could be addressed through a national agenda. I know that they say Mayor Pete instead of Mayor Buttigieg. I believe that he brings that younger generation into the Democratic discussion. I also believe that Mayor Bloomberg brings in that experience of having managed a large organization that's very urban, and at the same time, and since leaving office, he has addressed national issues like climate change.
Do you think it's even fair that people are questioning the competence of a small town mayor or even a Mayor Bloomberg because they don't have any experience? They don't have enough experience when we have a man in the White House who had no government experience at all, zero.
I think you've captured that exactly correctly. We can't decide that. You have to go out and work every day to talk to voters, to get them to understand and believe in your agenda. You have to not only prove that you have ideas, you have to put in place actions that would be acceptable to the communities that vote to do them.
But is the job similar? I mean, the mayor of any town is an administrator. They are a visionary. They are somebody who plans. They are somebody who uses their wiles to convince people on city council and citizens to see their vision and go forward with it. Doesn't that prepare you for the White House?
If it means that your hair gets whiter as you serve as mayor, I think that the answer is yes. It is yes. It is a job that requires you to, one, express to the community always confidence and empathy. It requires you to manage difficult situations and yet be planning for a hopeful future.
Speaking of the future, the city is working on the 2040 plan. It's the latest one. This will guide development and planning for growth for the next 20 years. We've had previous plans. Do we stick to them or do they sit on a shelf?
You know, I've heard people say, I think that great line about, oh, we'll have a plan and it'll be sitting on the shelf, or I've got 20 plans on the shelf. I think that's a bit of hyperbole, because if you look at the government center, it may not have been the very best plan and actually was not a great plan because it didn't address issues of equity. But for the time that plan was developed, almost every section of it has been implemented. And now we're trying to do something that addresses planning in the long term, that does deal with equity, does recognize the city as a whole instead of a part.
And you're putting this plan together at the same time work has begun on those unified development ordinance, which is something I don't understand, and no one has ever been able to explain it to me.
Okay, can I do a really short one?
Sure.
You have a plan, and it says, let's do something that's visionary and will lead to the future. an ordinance tells you how you're going to get it done. So it's kind of the zoning laws, it's the regulations that you have to put in place. So it's a plan and an implementation with the UDO.
So can you be putting that together at the same time you're putting together a 20-year plan?
Yes. If we're going to talk about mobility and that we're going to have a walkable city, if we know that, then we do have to start talking about where we build sidewalks. At the council retreat this past in January, we talked about filling in gaps on sidewalks. Many of us know you can walk down a street in Charlotte, and then all of a sudden it's like dirt or whatever, and, yeah. and it's not paved. So again, if we are going to be a city that you can walk in, the council has committed to filling in those gaps on sidewalks. That's where you take a plan and you put it in action.
Well, one thing that planning has to take into account, I think, particularly when it's a 20-year plan, is managing, when you're trying to manage and direct growth, you have to take mm-hmm. into account schools and where the population for those schools will be, how many you need, how many classrooms. But the city planning director and assistant city manager Taiwo Jayoba says, it's very challenging for CMS to plan more than 10 years out at a time. And we have an instance right now of the schools that were planned and allegedly funded in this 2017 bond referendum that they've already cut the number of classrooms in these high schools by 25 each. And that's because growth patterns have changed since 2017. So how can we include schools in a 20-year out plan?
That's a great discussion. We had that on Monday at the city council meeting. And, you know, many of us read in the newspaper about changes in the school system and what's going on. They have a much stronger connection with the county government because the Board of Commissioners do a lot of the local funding to support CMS. So at our meeting on Monday, I talked about reconnecting with our planning committee that's made up of all the bodies, the planning commission, the schools, the county, and the city. We have a committee like that, but they've not been as robust around some of these conversations. And with the 2040 plan, it's not necessarily just being robust. We need more than robust. We need buy-in and commitment that we're going to work towards one area and be able to adjust and move quickly. We're going to continue to do that. We have to talk a little bit more with our other leaders and those other boards. But as a city, we can't have a great city without better schools.
Okay. City Council at that annual retreat in beautiful downtown Tropical Durham. Had a bit of good news come out of it almost immediately, and that was the fact that no new property tax increase will be needed despite an increased deficit for FY21. I just read this. You're giving me this quizzical look like, what are you talking about? I read this, and I was going to ask you how that's possible. If we have a deficit, how do we have no tax increase?
Well, because every year we do projections. The projections on revenue come in, where they're adjusted, and our deficit has never been a deficit that requires a tax increase. So basically we adjust it through what we do on our expenses, and we look at that first. That's all how right. It doesn't end up being that.
You spend a large amount of time, focusing on transit and improving the bus system. And we've spoken with CATS Director John Lewis on this program a number of times about his plans and about the challenges he faces. And from your point of view and that of council, what improvements need to be made if we want to have a, quote, world-class, end quote, transit system?
Well, I'd settle for a really strong, good urban system, okay. Transit that would carry people. So we look at this under the mobility around the idea of can you get from your house to a job center and making employment easier by mass transit instead of a car. A car costs can be between $3,000 and $5,000 of income, and that's what we're trying to address. Economic mobility in one respect, but also the idea that we have to have a cleaner city. So what do I see? We are looking at having an average 50 15 minutes between bus stops so that you can have a reliable system that can get you places reliably, on time, that means. And also, how do we get you to places where the jobs are? Everyone has a sense that, well, you know, I have to have a car to get to work. How do we change that to, I have a reliable bus that I can take to work? With the I-77 Managed Lane Project, we've already started bus rapid transit from the northern towns into the center city. We're seeing that do very, very well in a subscription service. So mobility is about a number of things, all the way from walking and scooters and bikes to cars and to buses and trains. What we need to do is have vehicles that are needed to be on the road and to create choices for everyone else.
Well, being on time is important, and I think CATS has an 85% on-time arrival rate. Is that awful?
No, that's not awful. The problem is our arrival rates can sometimes be 45 minutes.
Okay.
15 minutes is something that we should be shooting for as an average.
But is that a CATS problem, or is that a traffic congestion problem?
It is both. You're right.
Because the buses are at the mercy of traffic flow.
Well, we can also have bus rapid transit. If you'll look along the, I think, 3rd Street now, we have a bus and bike only lane. And those buses get to move where cars are backed up. That bus is not backed up. So that's how we do this. I think you'll see a lot more investment in bus lanes only.
What does that mean to drivers in their cars?
That you'll have the opportunity to get out of your car and ride on a bus.
You're forcing the issue, I see. Okay.
We're creating choices. And if you actually don't have to pay for parking in the center city,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you see it at night and day,
right,
when people are coming into work. There are a lot of people that ride the buses. Just imagine if we don't have parking spaces and have productive spaces instead of using them for car storage, what we can do.
Now, Braxton Winston at one of the council meetings recently suggested that perhaps we ought to make the train and the bus system free. I've forgotten which city. It's somewhere in the Midwest that has already done this. I want to say Kansas City, but I could be wrong. And there's something about their tax base or the size of their system or whatever that makes it affordable, and somebody has said that would not be affordable here. Is that true?
I don't recall the city, and my experience is that there have been some systems, Houston, I believe, or some cities in Texas, that tried free. And free didn't really help change the ridership. What changes the ridership is reliability.
Okay.
And so it's not the cost necessarily. It doesn't matter if you ride free and you can't get there.
And you're starting, I understand, a transportation and mobility committee this month.
We're
right?
actually trying very hard to get a mobility committee. And, you know, one of the things that we talked about this in the context of transportation and rail and buses only, but at the council retreat, the council said, this is something that's very different. We need a plan for mobility. So how do we do that? How do we make South End continue to be successful with rail and buses? Because cars are going to be a problem.
Kansas City. I was right. Who knew? It's amazing that I could remember that. Mayor Vi Lyles is with us. She will continue to be with us as we go into the next segment here. We'll be talking about reducing violence, and we'll be talking about something that's about to... ice skating used to be synonymous with East Lamar.
Mm-hmm.
It will soon be soccer. Another S. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Mayor Vi Lyles is with us. She joins us once a month. This is her 20th once-a-month visit. Here she is.
Thanks to the listeners. They let me come back.
Right. Charlotte, we were talking about transit before the break, and Charlotte is more than a city. It is a region.
Mm-hmm.
And it would seem that transit planning also needs to be regional because people come and go from here every day to other parts of the region. And although we've seen a lot of non-binding pro-transit resolutions passed by area municipalities and councils, no funding proposals, no commitments have come into being. Any sign that will happen soon? And can we really build out this system and make it effective without the cooperation of Gaston County and York County and Cabarrus County and Union County?
Well, we've taken the first step. We do have the resolutions of support from other communities, Gastonia, Concord, Pineville has been always a part of our system, and they didn't elect when we built the system to have the rail in there, but now we need that to connect to the Ballantyne plan. So that's the first step. Now, the second step, we have a Metropolitan Transit Coalition that actually is a regional or countywide governance structure for our bus and train system. They, mayors from those communities that are looking at opportunities, Stallings, Indian Trail, they come to those meetings now. They're non-voting members, but the first step is always understanding education so that they can go back to their communities and talk about this. I would expect that it won't be in my time as mayor that we will begin to take action on these. If you look at the federal process for getting funding to build rail systems, it can be as long as 3 to 5 years. We're now just talking about it for the Silver Line because we have to do all of these studies to get the federal match. So I would expect, let us get through the Silver Line and then let's start talking, or actually let those mayors in those communities start talking about how they would fund their portion of a rail system.
And the Silver Line will actually go into another county out of it. It will go into Gaston County to Belmont.
It
correct.
Will not. It will be planned that way, but we have to still get the funding for it to do that.
But ultimately, that's the plan.
The plan is ultimately to have a light rail system that serves this region.
Okay.
I really believe not. It's required.
So affordable housing was a big priority in your first administration, and you were able to get that bond referendum through. It seems that will continue to be an effort in this 2-year period for you. But transit improvements or a reduction in violent crime are on the radar, too. How would you rank those three?
Can everything be a top priority?
Yeah,
I feel like every one of them takes attention. And fortunately, we've got a council that is organized in a way to address the policy deliverance on them all. They're very complex issues. Violent crime has some guiding principles that we're looking at, that it be evidence-based, it be community-focused. We've narrowed down some areas of geography that we think could concentrate for innovation and change. And we've brought in our public health department and our nonprofit health departments to start talking about how do we deal with violence interruptions. And so there's a lot to be done. It's a very complicated issue, but at the same time, it's all about lowering the amount of violent crimes, particularly murders, in our city this year. So we have Larkin Eggleston is leading our community safety committee that we're talking about building safe communities, and we're working hard on that one. Housing will always be an issue for us. It's a national issue. We're trying to keep up in our own way. We are challenged by the very poorest not having federal support for housing, and that's the kind of thing that I was talking about. If the federal government really wants to help a community, and it's not just urban communities, these are rural communities as well, they've got to fund rent subsidies for people making 30% and below. Now, we've just got to deal with that as a country. So we're really looking at our housing framework and saying, this is what we agreed to do, did we do it? Lots going on.
Yeah. At the end of last month, the city filed a rezoning petition for Eastland Mall, the old Eastland Mall site.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain this to me? Why does the city have to file a zoning petition to itself?
Because we treat ourselves just to the same standard we treat any other developer.
Okay. Has this ever been done before where the city comes in and files it?
Okay. We file text amendments to change around, noise and restaurants and bars, kinds of things like that.
So this petition rezoned 78 acres of the old Eastland Mall site, and when developed, it will include mixed-use, residential, commercial, office space, along with, I think, a hotel, transit facilities. This is the plan. Parks, athletic fields, and buildings for the Major League Soccer headquarters. Who makes the decision on this zoning petition?
Well, ultimately, we follow the same process that we would use for anyone else. So the staff will have community meetings. I'm sure that many council members will be involved and will keep up and follow the community's presentation and what their reactions would be. There are interest groups of influence, like, you know, the East Charlotte East organization that includes business owners and landowners in that area. So we'll be going through that community engagement process and that meeting. And then after that, it will have an analysis by our planning commission. And our planning commission will give us comments. That's a citizen-appointed group that's chosen by the council. And then we'll have a public hearing, and people will come down and comment to the council directly.
So that's why a decision will not come down before spring, because you have to do all that.
We will be doing all of that.
If the rezoning goes through, will all this happen with or without the $100-plus million that the city has said they would? They promised Major League Soccer they would kick into this project for something, whether it's improvements at B of A Stadium or Eastland Mall or the Gateway Center.
What we committed to do was to work with Tepper Sports Organization for two plans, and both of those plans are more extensive than the zoning process. The zoning is for that 78 acres. The plans are for those corridors, and so until we have a negotiation on the plans, the urgency around the rezoning is to actually work with something that we had in place before MLS decision was made to be on that site. It was actually when we were working with Crosland as a developer for the residential and retail portion of it. So when you say the money is about planning for a much bigger. The rezoning is necessary for us to react to those two parts of the development.
That money was made, well, the promise was made public prior to any public discussion. We've talked about this in the past. There's supposed to be public discussion about an expenditure of this size, and we made this promise to Major League Soccer, and now we're going through with rezoning petitions for Old Eastland Mall site to make it available for Major League Soccer. When will these public discussions be held?
Well, one, I think I talked about the public discussions that will take place with the rezoning decision.
So that's the same thing.
It is part of it. But as I said, the corridor portions of it, the entertainment district and the corridor that leads to Eastland, those are the commitments that we made to jointly work together. If you can have, we talk about opportunity zones. We talked about that for a lot. We have the ability to create something that's very much locally that will plan for something for a geography that we want to see happen, that will increase workforce planning, will increase the ability for people to be in this community and thrive. So I think our investment in that area is warranted if we have a plan that the public will participate in and comment on.
My understanding is that the city won't release any of this money until they get assurances from David Tepper that both the Panthers and the Major League Soccer team will stay in Charlotte. At least once somebody on council has said that, or somebody in city government. I think somebody in city government has said that. Has that promise been made? Has that commitment been made?
I recall these discussions, but let me get back to you on that one. Okay. I don't remember exactly, but we have. If we are going to invest in the MLS team, we are going to have a requirement, and there is a year time frame for that requirement for MLS.
Speaking of David Tepper, news broke sometime after your last visit here about campaign contributions that Mr. Tepper had made to you and members of City Council in the weeks before he officially asked for money to renovate the Bank of America Stadium. And Councilman Larkin Eggleston received $250 from the team's general counsel. And he said this was an unsolicited online donation. The idea that a donation that represents less than 1/3 of 1% of my total fundraising in the last election will determine where I will stand on one of the biggest votes we will take this term is laughable. He got $250. You received $5,200 from Mr. Tepper, but you don't have a vote on council on this issue.
Well, I do have votes in case of ties.
So are you concerned about how this looks?
I don't have any concern. I have you know, I've worked hard in this community. I've run for election 3 times before this one. Tepper's a new member of our community, but if you look at my fundraising records, you can see people in this community from, you know, $10 a month, $2 a month, up to the maximum contribution. I think that's an endorsement of our leadership and what we're doing, and I feel very comfortable that if people look at what I have done in the past, that they will see that my goal is always around building a really, really great city. And people that helped me get that opportunity to do that, I'm grateful.
But that may not be every politician's goal.
That may not be every politician's goal, but it's mine. That's what I own.
Okay. But shouldn't we take money like that out of politics? It just seems greasy to me.
And you would suggest that we do what?
I don't know.
Would you suggest that?
That's why I'm not a politician.
If we have campaign reform, I'd love to see how we would do that. I think people abide by the law.
Free advertising.
Thank you.
That will go.
Okay, let's see if WFAE is going to give how much they're going to give me.
We don't have any advertising. There you go.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So there you go. But we just sent a shudder to the television community. Jana on Facebook writes, what's going to happen to the Saturday markets at Eastland when all this development begins to happen? Is there going to be a space for those vendors and customers set aside nearby?
My understanding is that Dave Tepper has gone out and met with several of those owners and that he has committed to continue that market space.
And Sean,
not in the same way, but a market space, yes.
And Sean on Twitter writes, when will plans for the Major League Soccer team headquarters at Eastland and the stadium renovation plans become public? The Eastland plans have been printed in the newspaper.
In the paper, and I'm sure that if there's a permit already, a building permit for the stadium, that's online as well.
Well, yeah, I think that's been published as well.
I think
because
it has
some people are losing their PSL seats.
I saw that article, yes.
The new tunnel that's being built for soccer. Well, you may have heard, I'm not sure, but maybe you have, the Republican National Convention is coming to town in August. From what you've heard from convention planners, from the Secret Service, the FBI, CMPD, will there be any substantial difference to people who live and work here in terms of how we will be impacted for this convention versus the 2016 Democratic National Convention?
So we had an update on Monday from both the chief as well as Angela Charles, who is leading the internal. There are lots of things that have to take place that are for this convention. Transportation planning, security, I think, are the two big ones. The chief has said that we've learned well from 2012 and should be able to do the same for 2020.
See, it was the 2012 Democratic Convention. I keep pushing it to 2016 because it just seems like yesterday to me. But Chief Putney seems confident that this convention and the surrounding events, and that means protests and parties and things like that, will be orderly. And that if anything does happen, he is equipped to handle it. Are you equally certain about that?
I can certainly say that Chief Putney's a lot better versed in that area than I am. Our goal is to have a safe convention and to deal with issues as they come up in that unique, specific incident. And so I think that he has said, working with the Secret Service, those two agencies, CMPD, that one, he thinks that he has actually said that we're getting cooperation from other community police departments. That's a good sign. He's got the logistics underway for housing the number of officers that will come into the city. He's got, you know, simple things like who's going to feed all of these folks, and he's all of that's underway. The perimeter decision will be made about the same time the 2012 decision was made, and that when we make that decision, people inside the perimeter, the security perimeter, will have some decisions to make about where they have workforce and what they do and how they react. I think one of the things that's been different, and this isn't a part of what the city's doing, but the host committee is talking with the smaller shops inside the perimeter to talk about the impact. That was one of the things we didn't get to in 12 that they are going to try to make sure it happens in 20.
Isn't this a smaller convention than the Democratic convention?
It is a smaller convention in terms of the number of delegates and inside the space, but the biggest part of it is the media coverage. I mean, thousands of media people will be coming to our city, and that makes a big difference.
Councilman Malcolm Graham is worried about housing the homeless during this because he says every hotel room will be needed, and it seems to me that people who live in motels and hotels that cater to homeless people, they are not delegates to the Republican National Convention.
I doubt seriously that they will be.
But we are putting on a show, just as the GOP is putting on a show for the country, we're putting on a show for the GOP, and there's no plan to move homeless people off the streets. Is that
a
mistake?
That's exactly what the chief said. And we had the same issue in 12. People asked the same question about the homeless, what will happen, and people were like, oh, we're going to put them on buses and ride them around town all night. And that was just a rumor.
Okay.
I think that our community will plan appropriately.
Mayor Vi Lyles joins us once a month. I guess you're back in March, right?
I'll see you in March.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.